I'm Tom Hall. This is the Midday News Wrap. A black student, Richard Collins III, is stabbed to death by a white student at the University of Maryland. Is the flagship campus of the state's university system doing enough to counter racism and bias? President Trump wraps up a 9-day foreign trip tomorrow. He gives the Saudis and the Pope a thumbs up, and he gives NATO a stern lecture. The flow of intelligence leaks to the media continues. Great Britain is not amused. Trump himself is no doubt not amused by revelations that the FBI is investigating his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, as the Russia probe continues and expands. Kamal High of the Afro-American newspaper and Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead of Loyola University, Maryland, join me to look behind the headlines. Plus, music from Austin Coughlin and Mike Check in advance of a benefit concert for the Southern Poverty Law Center. Midday starts right after the news. And good afternoon on this beginning of the Memorial Day weekend. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Very glad you are with us, and welcome to the Midday News Wrap. Last weekend, a Bowie State University student, Richard Collins III, was stabbed to death by a University of Maryland student named Sean Urbanski. This attack took place on the University of Maryland campus in College Park. Collins was black. Urbanski, who is white, is a member of an online hate group. No word yet if Urbanski will be charged with a hate crime. The University of Maryland addressed the tragedy by announcing changes to the way that they approach racism on campus. Those changes include an additional $100,000 to their Office of Diversity and Inclusion and a new task force that will focus on hate bias and campus safety. But University of Maryland students say that longstanding racial tension on campus is often ignored by university officials, even when students report incidents of bias. In national news, Housing and Urban Development Secretary Ben Carson set off a firestorm when he said in an interview, quote, "Poverty is a state of mind." Donald Trump's new budget plan seems to echo that sentiment. The president wants to cut trillions of dollars from federal programs like Medicaid and the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program known as SNAP. So how are politicians on both sides of the aisle reacting, and how should the cuts impact, or how could the cuts, rather, impact people who rely on federal assistance programs? President talked tough at the NATO meeting. Great Britain is furious with the U.S. for intelligence leaks to the media about the terrorist bombing in Manchester, England. President Trump has called for an investigation to reveal the source of that leak. Republican Greg Gianforte won a special congressional election in Montana yesterday after getting an assault charge for body-slamming Ben Jacobs, a reporter who grew up here in Baltimore. The Washington Post reported yesterday that Jared Kushner has been identified as a subject of an investigation by the FBI for interactions with Russian diplomats and businessmen. So as always, we've got lots to talk about with our News Wrap panel. Kamal High joins us here in Studio A. He's the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper based here in Baltimore. He's a former reporter and digital producer in New York for The Wall Street Journal and The Financial Times, among other publications. Kamal, good to see you.
Good to see you, Tom. How are you?
I'm doing great, thanks. And Dr. K.Y.'s Whitehead is here as well. She's an associate professor of communications in African and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, and the founding executive director of the Emily Frances Davis Center for Education, Research, and Culture. She's also the author of several books, including Letters to My Black Sons, Raising Boys in a Post-Racial America. Dr. K, as always, a pleasure to see you.
Thank you so much.
You are welcome to join our conversation about the news of the week. 410-662-8780 is our number here at Midday. Our email, midday@wypr.org. And if you want to join us on Twitter, @MiddayTomHall. So, Richard Collins III, this is a story that in certain
ways— Second Lieutenant Richard Collins.
Second Lieutenant, just recently commissioned as a second lieutenant in the Army days before he was to graduate from Bowie State on Tuesday. Bowie State honored Mr. Collins at their commencement ceremony on Tuesday. His father, Richard Collins Jr., accepted his degree, and here he is talking with NBC News earlier this week.
He was a competitor. He prided himself on his time and his ROTC unit being the top runner in his PTs and physical training, that is, tests that they would give. And, you know, he even won a certificate for being the best, scoring the highest points on his physical training tests. So he was just competitive at heart, you know, and had a loving and giving heart. He'd go out of his way, sometime to my chagrin, to try and help others, you know. But, you know, you want to encourage that in your children. I tried to instill in him, his mother and I tried to instill in him to, there's always balance, you know, try and maintain balance. And he loved God, the God that we serve. In particular, he was a child of God, and he believed in Christ Jesus, which is what we taught him since he was an infant.
It's just heartbreaking, Kay Whitehead. And when I heard about this horrible murder, I thought immediately of your two sons, whom I've had the great pleasure and honor of meeting over the years and seeing them grow up, Kofi and Amir. You wrote a book called Letter to My Black Sons. Obviously, this hits incredibly close to home when you hear about this happening, but you are also an academic. You're on a campus. You're at the University of Loyola University, Maryland. So you're familiar with that milieu as well. What's your thoughts about how this happened, why this happened, and the role that the university plays in having it happen?
Thank you so much for inviting me on the show and for mentioning my sons, which I always try to bring into any space. I enter into this work, this particular story, from a lot of different perspectives. As a Black mother, it is very challenging for me to wrestle with this, to think about new ways to help my sons learn how to navigate through this society. We've been working on this since Trayvon Martin and the birth of Black Lives Matter. I've switched gears a number of times, as you know, where we have been activists on the ground, and I've taught them about activism, where I've taught them how to get low and just stay out of the way so you can get home. I'm trying so hard to focus on not just survival mode, because I think Black children are now being taught you just have to survive, you have to get low, you have to be respectful, you have to move when you're told to move, so you can get home safely. I want to teach them how to thrive now. I'm talking about how do you live your best life and how do you try to be in the spaces that you should and you can be in because you are a part of this country. So that's one perspective. I think the other perspective that you mentioned is I am a professor at Loyola University, and some of the issues that I see happening at University of Maryland College Park are not necessarily happening on my campus in terms of, you know, chalkings of bodies and nooses and, you know, flyers about lynchings, all of this that has been on the rise since the inauguration of President Donald Trump. And, you know, University of Maryland College Park has a long history of having these racist incidences happening on campus and having the administration call this just another exercise in free speech. That does not happen at Loyola University. I think as a Jesuit campus, we have taken a very strong stand against this type of activity because you have to deal with it on the lowest level and you have to deal with it as quickly and as swiftly as possible because it starts with the noose, it starts with hate speech, and it continues to rise until you have a student who's been wearing Ravens gear on campus, then moving out to then take the life of an African-American just because he happens to be standing there. You want him to move, and he does not have to, but you feel that he should. Simply because of the color of his skin.
Yeah, Kamau Hi. I mean, the Ravens gear, you know, a little detail that several publications have reported, you know, meaning this is a normal kid. He went to the library, studied, you know, did stuff, and then all of a sudden, just completely unprovoked, he was a stranger to Mr. Collins, didn't know him, gets drunk and attacks him with a knife and kills him.
Yes, I mean, anytime you're accused of murder, I'm going to question just how normal you are. And then I'd also like to say that I was just speaking with someone from Bowie State University before I got here, and the funeral for Second Lieutenant Richard Collins started around 11 o'clock this morning, and there is a large contingent of Bowie students and faculty and administration there in support of him. I mean, this is the sort of thing that you hear about and you go, what sort of universe are we living in? And I'd also like to point out that University of Maryland has a long history of segregation. The former president, H.C. Curly Byrd, for whom they named the stadium after, up until the 60s, was a staunch opponent of integrating students into the school. And that is the legacy of it.
So 50 years later, the University of Maryland come out, is not able to overcome that legacy, to erase that legacy, to move past that legacy. I mean, Kay mentioned the noose. There was a noose found. This is earlier this month, the beginning of May. A noose found hanging in the kitchen in a fraternity house in the University of Maryland. I wonder, what can the administration, obviously Wallace Lowe, the president of the university, doesn't condone this kind of
obviously.
Stuff.
Obviously.
In terms of...
he's also a person of color.
Yeah. An immigrant. You know, what can they do? What should they be doing? Or are there things, and I'll ask Kay this as well, that they're not doing that people at Loyola and other universities are?
Well, I think one of the first things is raising awareness, and that currently the many University of Maryland students are using the hashtag #FearTheTurtle, which is traditionally associated with the sports teams, but they are using that hashtag to share their stories of racial discrimination at the university. We'll actually be having a story going up this week on weekend on Afro.com. But, you know, sort of reading through that hashtag, you know, you really see some sort of chilling examples of sort of everyday casual racism, not, you know, sort of like I got punched because I was black, but more sort of just weird questions and sort of bad behavior that seem somewhat common there.
And Kay Whitehead, Dave Zirin writing in The Nation called this a lynching, which of course it is.
I mean, which I
a lynching with a knife.
Oh, I wholeheartedly agree with, particularly the sentiments around lynching and the same sentiments that were used by this gentleman with the knife.
He quotes a student, an undergraduate student named Brendan Sullivan, who wrote on Facebook addressing the president. He says, "Hey, Wallace Lowe, through your failure to address racism, white supremacists, hate speech, and violence against people of color, you've created an atmosphere where racists are emboldened." So how does one balance, if that's the right word, the right of hate speech and the deleterious and hideous effect that that has on the culture of a campus?
I think we're at this point that we are wrestling with this as a nation. I think the University of Maryland College Park, I think of the incident I just read about Crofton Middle School, and there was a noose found there, and they are definitely pursuing it as a hate crime, that we're wrestling with this new feeling of freedom around being able to say whatever you want to say and do whatever you want to do. It's under the guise of free speech, and what it really is hate speech, is hate activity, is extremely racist, it's extremely divisive. And so if it comes down from the White House, and unfortunately, it seems like every time you get into these conversations, you find your way on a path back towards the White House and back towards Trump, who permeates every feeling around this. I don't say it's Trump the person. I say it's the Trump era, this feeling that you can now not have to worry about being polite with these things. I felt like for 8 years, we were being very polite in our conversations about race. At the same time, we had a fire raging with Black Lives Matter, but we were being very polite in our speech and in our actions outside in front of the camera and on Facebook. But now that blanket has been pulled back and people feel emboldened to say the things that they always said around their kitchen table, the things they said anonymously are now being able to be shared, and you have support for the things you want to talk about.
Of course, this is not the first time that an unprovoked attack against a person of color has happened. And another one happened just, you know, a couple of months ago. James Harris Jackson, a 28-year-old guy, went to the Friends School here in Baltimore. And it's no slam on the Friends School. Yeah. It's a Quaker school. Mm-hmm. He grew up in an environment in which, you know, tolerance and peace was the animating force. But, you know, there's some evidence that he suffers from PTSD. He went to Manhattan to seek out a black person and, in fact, killed a gentleman named Timothy Kaufman. That was on the 20th of March. You've also got a woman in New Jersey, Angela Jones, who attacked a man, a white man, at a gas station and beat up his Porsche and his boat and clawed the man in the face because she said she was sick of fancy white people. You've got white teenagers accosted by black teenagers in Chicago earlier in the year, and they recorded this on Facebook. I mean, Kamau, are we at a point where we're back to race wars? What's going on?
Well, I don't know if it's race wars per se, but I will say that it is the cesspool that is the internet. And as a journalist, I am obviously a First Amendment absolutist. But if you spend any time at all, and even some, you know, what you would consider somewhat safe spaces on the internet, the sort of the use of memes to carry forward sort of hideous racist ideology under the guise of irony and sarcasm is truly prevalent. It's really sort of breathtaking if you ever sort of take a deep dive into it. You want to take a shower afterwards.
That's a good point. We will pick up on that and other items in the news when we come back from a break. Kamau High is the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper based here in Baltimore. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead is on the faculty of Loyola University, Maryland, and the founding executive director of the Emily Frances Davis Center for Education, Research, and Culture. We'll have more of the Midday News Wrap when we come back. 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. You can follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. Stick around.
You're listening to Midday here on your public radio, 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up a little later today, some music by the composer and performer Austin Coughlin. He's a musician. He and a musician named Mike Check are going to play a few tunes for us here live in Studio A in advance of a concert that they're giving tomorrow to benefit the Southern Poverty Law Center. So stay tuned for that. And by the way, coming up Monday on Memorial Day, a rebroadcast of our conversation about media diversity. Last month, NPR released their 2016 newsroom diversity numbers, and they acknowledged that they've made little progress in their goal to increase the number of journalists of color working at NPR. They're not alone. According to the Columbia Journalism Review, newsroom diversity has nearly flatlined for more than a decade. Veteran journalists Richard Prince and Farai Chidea join me along with Keith Woods, the vice president of diversity and training at NPR. That's coming up on Midday Monday. If you're just joining us today, it's the Midday News Wrap with Dr. K. Wise Whitehead. She's an associate professor of communication in African and African-American studies at Loyola University, Maryland, and Kamau High. He's the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper. If you'd like to join our conversation to talk about the news events of the week, 410-662-8780, our email midday@wipr.org. Follow us on Twitter @MiddayTomHall. So, Kay Whitehead, the University of Maryland issued five action items that they plan to undertake in the wake of the death of Second Lieutenant Collins. The first is that they're asking the Office of Diversity and Inclusion to create a rapid response team to any hate bias incident. They're going to give $100,000 to the Office of Diversity and Inclusion to, you know, further enhance their efforts. They're going to ask them to the Office of Civil Rights and Sexual Misconduct. So, first of all, they have all these offices.
You know,
they have
they
offices of diversity and sexual misconduct.
Yes.
And also,
apparently, they're not working very well.
Yeah, they're going to issue annual reports on the hate bias crimes and incidents on campus, so people will know about them. They're going to ask the Athletic Council to consider how to strengthen existing policies within the intercollegiate athletic realm, and they're going to establish a task force, which is something that people do in situations like this. So, given, you know, that those are all noble endeavors, but what is the capacity of those kinds of things? What is the capacity of the institution to change the culture or the sick mind of a person like this kid Urbanski?
Well, I have to say that I'm an optimistic swimmer who drowns in pessimistic water. So I am optimistic that you're going to have a task force and throw hundreds of thousands of dollars behind this problem. I am pessimistic because I understand that this problem cannot be solved by just throwing money at it, by setting up a task force, by having conversations. This is a deep-rooted problem around white supremacy that permeates throughout the country. You cannot uproot it at the University of Maryland College Park and not uproot it in America, because you can work on the students you have today, and you'll have a new crop of students coming in tomorrow who still have these same ideas. I mean, I've been working on diversity, and it's recently become equity and inclusion, because we realize diversity has kind of a nasty twing to it, and diversity sounds very polite. But I've been doing it for 15 years. And the same people that I've been arguing with before we were arguing by phone and arguing by email 15 years ago, we're now arguing by Facebook and by Twitter, and they have not moved at all in the feelings that they have around black and brown bodies and how they are seen as being inferior. So although I appreciate the attempt to want to do something. I know that the attempt to want to do something is rooted in the reality of somebody had to die to get us to this point. The incidences that happened at College Park, from the nooses to the chalks to the threats of lynchings to the flyers, was not enough to move them to make any real substantial changes. Why does someone have to die? A black or brown child has to die before we say, you know, we have a problem here we have to address. Why not say with the noose on campus, that is a problem. Let's address it before we get to this next level.
When it comes to the internet, Kamau, I mean, for example, would it be a good idea to monitor the Facebook and Twitter conversations and posts of students at the University of Maryland? And if were this alt-right, which he, the site that Urbanski evidently subscribed to, which some people have, as you were alluding to before, described as this sort of ironic thing, you know. But it's a takeoff on the alt-right meme that, you know, we've come to know since Steve Bannon took over the Trump campaign last summer. I mean, should that kind of stuff be monitored by university officials and say, okay, well, here's a bad egg, we got to get rid of them?
Well, again, as a journalist, I'm anti sort of monitoring people's conversations. I think you should be able to say whatever you want, wherever you want. You just have to be willing to face the consequences of that. I would say...
So should the consequences being kicked out of college?
It depends. I mean, I'm reluctant to sort of give it an absolutist answer, but I would say yes. I mean, you know, you can't stand in a movie theater and yell fire because there will be consequences to that. Whether or not you should be allowed to share memes that sort of invoke Hitler imagery among, say, a group of a private Facebook group, I would probably fall on the side of sure. If you want to, that makes you a bad person, but it's not against the law.
You know, when we have controversies like, you know, people like Ann Coulter, you know, I'm going to talk at Berkeley, I'm not going to talk at Berkeley, I'm going to make this speech here, I'm going to make that speech there. No, the security concerns outweigh the free speech concerns. Campuses, college campuses, Kay, are really the, in so many ways, you know, the nexus of all of these very important philosophical, constitutional issues. And then it gets... You know, on top of that, it's imbued with this very complicated and very horrible history of racial inequality in the country.
I think what's interesting is that the campus is supposed to be the place where you work through these issues. You send your kids off to college, and my kids are thankfully not that age yet, but you send your kids off to college with the idea that they're going to be challenged, they're going to be pushed, they're going to wrestle with some of these bigger questions around what it means to be a citizen and where do we stand on the issue of race and what does sexism really look like when it's played out every day in our lives. So in many ways, I think that it is on the campus where I want to encourage you these conversations happening, which is why I taught a Black Lives Matter course this spring. In my course, 90% of the students were white students, you know, looking to wrestle with these issues and opening up the environment and telling them that anything you want to say, you can say it here. Because I'd rather you say it here, I can address it here, we can work through it here, than for you to keep it inside and you carry those feelings with you. So I don't want to shut down free speech on a college campus. My concern as a mom, as someone who uses the internet, as a black woman in America who's constantly concerned about my own safety and the safety of my boys, I'm concerned that the internet, as this cesspool, which is what our guests call this cesspool, where you can say and do anything, it's now becoming the way in which we live our lives. People are living their lives through Facebook. They're finding people that they agree with. They're reading things and they're getting concerned and they're getting upset and they're taking those things at face value. And then they're moving from this kind of fantasy world into the real world and not understanding that in the real world, when you stab someone, they bleed and die. When you shoot someone, they bleed and die. And you are killing that person and not necessarily killing the idea that you're trying to stand against.
And when it comes to arguments like they've just had in New Orleans about the removal of Confederate monuments that, you know, were scattered around the city, Baltimore went through the same conversation. St. Louis, other cities mm-hmm. around the country have done the same thing. I mean, the understanding of history is sort of, you know, for many people, the place to start when it comes to conversations. But as Kay's mentioning, and since the election, I think we've seen there is this really strident bifurcation of philosophy and understanding of where we are as a country. And when it comes to persuading, I mean, I interviewed people who wrote about the Clinton campaign, and they, in fact, decided they weren't going to try to even persuade Trump voters to vote for Secretary Clinton. They just said, we're going to give up on those people because you cannot persuade them. 80% of Republicans still support President Trump, who's had a, you know, chaotic first few months in office, whereas, you know, it's much less than 40% of the country as a whole supports the president. How does one get through this bifurcation and gets to the point where people are, in fact, persuaded to not hold racist views, to not hold views that are intolerant? How do we get there?
Well, I would point out that Baltimore is, in fact, slightly different than New Orleans because they are actually bringing down their Confederate monuments, whereas Baltimore, there remains a statue of Robert E. Lee in Stonewall Jackson right across the street from the Baltimore Museum of Art, which is actually not that far from these studios. And while there is a plaque, a very small plaque, next to them that puts it in context, when you come down that street, you see a very large statue of Robert E. Lee and go, man, that's a statue of Robert E. Lee. Didn't he lose this war? But sort of to the larger question of...
Yeah, and you don't see the plaque,
no.
The explanation plaque from Charles Street.
Exactly. I mean, you know, when did we start honoring traitors? That's a weird thing. It'd be like honoring the kamikaze fighters at Pearl Harbor. You know, it's just not particularly an American thing to do. But sort of the larger question of how do you end racism? I mean, I think this is something that we've been grappling with as a country since the days of yore. If I had the answer to that question, I would have stopped racism.
Yeah, that would have been nice if you
Yes. We would say thank you.
Yeah, I do want to mention, just in that same vein, that the Supreme Court ruled this week that there were districts in North Carolina, the 5th and the 12th district, which were unconstitutionally racially gerrymandered. Mm-hmm. So there's a legal remedy that people are saying no, because what they tried to do is put basically all the black voters in two districts to segregate them literally from white districts so that these other districts would, you know, putatively vote for white candidates. The case called Cooper versus Harris. But, and there are other court rulings, you know, in the pipeline. Now, one of the things, I want to pivot a little bit to the president. He's been overseas now for 8 of his 9-day days on this foreign trip that he's doing. Huge kerfluffle concerning leaks of intelligence again, Kay Whitehead. Great Britain just mad as can be about leaks to the New York Times with photographs of the crime scene and even the name of the perpetrator of this attack at the Ariana Grande concert. Where does this stand in the panoply of this, you know, chaotic few months of the Trump administration? We should also say, by the way, the BBC is reporting that the U.S. officials, or the U.K. officials, rather, British officials, think that it's law enforcement rather than White House people who are making these leaks, although we have obviously no way of confirming it.
I think an interesting thing this week for me was reading that Trump was exhausted. And I stopped and I had to think about that because I am completely exhausted under the Trump presidency as well. I feel that this has been a few months where you get very little sleep. I mean, I am on Twitter 24/7 to try to keep up with everything that is coming from the White House, the ways in which the country is being shifted, the ways in which we're being emotionally pulled in a number of different directions, the ways in which we're becoming so deeply divided that I am concerned we may never come back together. I think in the beginning, I was one of the people, we laughed about it. We would look at the memes and we would look at all of all the mistakes he was making. And it was funny in the beginning. And now I think that there's nothing funny about what is happening. There's nothing funny about where America is being situated in the world. There's nothing funny when I see my president knocking people out of the way for a photo opportunity. There's nothing funny when I see the ways in which we're focused on all of the mistakes, because the mistakes that he's making are not his alone. He is a representative of the highest office in the land. He represents our country. And I think under the Obama administration, what we call the days of yore now, under the Obama administration, it was a different sight in terms of the respectability politics. I have no idea what he was doing behind the scenes, but there was always this image that he was extremely respectful and he was respected, him and his wife. I have a different image. I feel that we are being mocked, and not just mocked outside of our country, but inside of our country. And I think underneath the mocking, we need to deal with the fact that our country is changing in ways that we may never recover
from.
So,
Kamau, when the president returns tomorrow, what do you think the general take on his trip is going to be? I mean, has he handled himself well? Has he made irretractable, you know, intractable mistakes? Did he come off okay? What do you think?
I mean, you know, he did manage to not insult Islam, so I guess that's good. You know, I would say that Donald Trump has been obsequious to the Saudis and sort of standoffish to our long-term allies in the NATO and the G7. And I think that is the direction that the Trump administration is headed. They are quite happy with that projected image.
I mean, given the number of changes of his positions during the campaign that he has instituted since being elected, he was at least consistent when he goes to NATO and says, "You all need to pay more."
Yes, although he does mistakenly think that NATO owes
yes.
I think America he yes. thinks the money, even though that is not how at all it works.
Yeah, and his intimations that certain countries in NATO are not paying their fair share, you know, are a matter of scrutiny and a matter of you know, alternative facts.
Well, it is true that the vast majority of NATO members do not pay the recommended 2% of their annual budgets to essentially buy defense weapons and military and things of that nature. It's just that, generally speaking, we as Americans, being the most powerful nation in the world, don't make an issue of it because it's gauche.
And of course, the goals for when that 2% plateau is going to be reached, include another 10 years for some.
Yes.
I mean, there are subtleties to this. I mean, it's not unusual for any politician to sort of gloss over the subtleties, and Mr. Trump is certainly not known for being subtle in his pronouncements. But again, some of his pronouncements about NATO simply are factually inaccurate, and we need to keep that in mind. On the domestic front, we've got a budget that he has suggested. And again, this becomes a blueprint. This becomes sort of a philosophical statement rather than an actual allocation and appropriation of funds. When it comes to programs for economically disadvantaged people, people are quick to point out that a number of these programs would be slashed almost irrecognizably by the administration. Here's what Dr. Ben Carson, who of course folks in Baltimore know, is a very gifted brain surgeon from Johns Hopkins University. He's now a member of the cabinet, the head of HUD. Here's what he had to say the other day.
I think poverty, to a large extent, is also a state of mind. You take somebody who has the right mindset, you can take everything from them and put them on the street. And I guarantee you, in a little while, they'll be right back up there. And you take somebody with the wrong mindset, you can give them everything in the world. They'll work their way back down to the bottom.
Kay Whitehead, your response.
I think that I'm the person who is trying very hard not to laugh at some of the stupidity that I'm hearing from the cabinet. And that comment alone, I understand when I read more in detail what Ben Carson talked about, using his mother as an example, that if his mother was the mother of every, I think, poor person in America, there would be no poverty because she simply did not accept it. I don't think accepting it is the answer to solving. It may be one of the answers, but if you are in a cycle of oppression, if you are in a cycle where you are consistently being born into situations where there seems to be no out, it's not just about thinking that you're going to be better and thinking that you're going to change your mindset. It begins in the schools. It begins in kindergarten. It begins in first grade. If you attend a school where the students are being undereducated, or in the words of Carter G. Woodson, miseducated, well, there's a way that you're being consistently worked behind every year of your life. So thinking your way out of the situation, although it sounds noble, I would argue, and I think research would bear it out, is not enough.
And Kamau, an activist or a resident of Sandtown Winchester or of East Baltimore has a lived experience that she may say, that's not the way it works, Dr. Carson. On the other hand, Dr. Carson himself has a lived experience that says that's exactly how it works. You have a strong mother, you take education seriously, and you lift yourself out of poverty. This is a man who has lived in poverty as a child. What do you say to his contention that it is largely to do with a state of mind and a mindset about being poor?
Well, I mean, I certainly cannot diminish Ben Carson or Dr. Ben Carson's experience. I mean, his experience is his experience. But what strikes me as interesting is that he points out that his mother was strong and involved in his education and his upbringing, and that unfortunately many children here in Baltimore and across America do not have quite as strong a mother or other parent or guardian sort of looking out for them, making sure not only that they go to school, but advocate for them at school, make sure that they are in the right classes, doing the right activities, and preparing them for success. I mean, we all know that, as Hillary Clinton would say, it takes a village to raise a child. And if you do not have that village, your chances are slim of success.
Let's try to sneak in a couple of phone calls before we run out of time. Phil in Baltimore, welcome to Midday with Kamau High and Kay Whitehead.
Oh, good afternoon. Yes, I take issue with people who want to take down the statues of Robert E. Lee and Stonewall Jackson because it's part of American history. No matter how you feel about the Civil War, which side is right, it's very much a part of American history, and I don't like taking monuments down of famous people, okay? And also, the gentleman mentioned about the beginning of World War II. There were kamikaze pilots at Pearl Harbor. No, there weren't, actually. That came much later in the war. Not until 1945 did the Japanese use kamikaze pilots in desperation, and at Pearl Harbor, they just bombed Pearl Harbor. Yes, but okay, well, the main point, you know, historical accuracy is important, and I don't like taking down statues, even if you don't like the Confederate cause.
All right. Well, Phil, thank you for your call. And Kamau actually said nothing about the dating of kamikaze involvement
exactly.
in World War II. But Kay Whitehead, Phil says we need to respect history. Is taking down these monuments being disrespectful to history?
I think what's interesting is when people talk about respecting history, then if I was in a conversation with Phil or anyone, I would say respect whose history? Respect what type of history? I mean, what are you talking about when you're saying respecting history and we have to keep the monuments up? If the monument or the person stands for something that for a lot of people in this country, particularly people who are African American, that was a time in our country where you had a segment of our population who were fighting to keep us enslaved, to keep us in an inferior position. And so we ride by, for those who even recognize the statue, let's be real, when we talk about people even knowing who that person is, recognize the statue, seeing that that was a moment in time that we are still trying to move away from. It is about a time when you felt that you were being raped, and there's a big statue of the rapist. And you're like, well, no, it's American history. We got to keep that up. Well, if this means something to me, you see it as a historical moment. I see it as a moment when my people were impressed, and I'm still trying to get past.
One final quick thought, Kamau High.
Yeah, I would say that, yes, obviously history is important. I was a history major. History belongs in museums. You know, when you lose the war, we do not build monuments to you. Leaving those statues up is, and the other thing is that many of the statues, particularly here in Baltimore of the Confederacy, went up in the 1940s and 50s. They did not happen right after the war. They were merely put up as sort of monuments to segregation.
Well, that's all the time we have today. I very much appreciate both of you guys coming
by
and have a good Memorial Day weekend.
Thank you very much.
Kamau High is the managing editor of the Afro-American newspaper. Dr. K. Wise Whitehead is on the faculty of Loyola University, Maryland. Coming up after a break, the guy who composed the theme music for our show, Austin Coughlin, is going to join me along with another musician who goes by the name of Mike Check. They'll give a live performance for us here in Studio A. And before we take that break, as this Memorial Day weekend begins, we want to acknowledge the Maryland servicemen and women who lost their lives in the line of duty during this past year. They'll be honored on Monday at a ceremony at Delaney Valley Memorial Gardens in Timonium. This is the 50th year of this annual observance. U.S. Navy Commander and NASA astronaut G. Reed Wiseman will give the keynote address. The event begins at 10 o'clock Monday morning. We extend our sympathy and our thanks to the families of the following Maryland servicemen who will be remembered at that event. Airman First Class Nathaniel H. McDavitt of Severna Park. He was killed on April 15, 2016 in Jordan by the Islamic State. Private First Class Victor Stanfield of Fulton. He died on May 10, 2016 from injuries suffered during a live fire training exercise at Fort Polk, Louisiana. Staff Sergeant Adam S. Thomas of Tacoma Park was killed by an improvised bomb on October 4, 2016, during a mission against the Islamic State in Afghanistan. Sergeant First Class Alan E. Brown of Tacoma Park died on December 6, 2016, from wounds that he suffered in a suicide bomb attack in Afghanistan the month before. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
This is Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.